Let us begin.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa sambuddhassa. Namo tassa
Iti piso bhagava parang sam sam veda jangan sam When you hear it, Subhatibhano bhagavato sāvaka saṅgho Ujjupatibhano bhagavato sāvaka saṅgho Nyāyapatibhano bhagavato sāvaka saṅgho Sāmīpatibhano bhagavato sāvaka saṅgho Yadidam chatari purisa yugani Atta purisa pungkava Esa bhagavato sāvaka saṅgho Auneyo pauneyo dakirneyo Anjani karapiyo Atta Okay, very good. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Okay. So, you let me want to keep that door open just for a few minutes. Do you want to just open the door for a few minutes? Because usually there might be a couple of people coming in a bit late. So make sure that they're okay. See, there you go. I sensed him. I sensed the presence. Somehow I knew. Somehow. There was a power. There was a magnificence. And there was a manifestation. How did I know that? I don't know. I don't know. I don't know. Hey, my sensing. All right. So now I have to show you something. So this is just before we begin, okay? This is a bit of a deep cut. So this is for those of you who were with us roughly 2 years ago in, you can just leave the door open for now. We'll close it in a minute. This is for those who were with us for about 2 years ago in Harris Park on one rainy night, dismal rainy night. Dismal Dhamma talk, probably. And while we were doing the Dhamma talk, there was the piteous mewling of a lost kitten. Pathetically, you remember? Echo, remember? You guys remember? Right? And we're like, what's that? So eventually we went out looking for it. And one of our kind community members, Amanda, decided to take that cat in and look after it. So now, as it happened, Amanda moved away. And we didn't really see her, so we didn't really know what happened with that. But I just literally ran into her just now in North Sydney. And she's like, Bhante. I'm like, sorry, who are you? And anyway, so here is that cat. So that kitten is flourishing maybe a little bit too much, looked after. So so that's one of the longest cliffhangers that we've ever had in these talks. Ah, really? Yeah.
When's that?
Oh,
just the back alley of the
family. Oh, right. It seems so, yeah. Anyway, so here we are. We're going to have a look during the break. Just show for the folks online. There we go. All right. So there you go. There's that happy cat. Anyway, so I just thought that you might want to know that little update on that story. Okay. Right, so we're going to do some meditation. Who wants to do some meditation? Yes. Yay, you're in the right place. Hi, welcome. Okay, and why do we want to do some meditation? Inner peace. That sounds pretty good. Okay. Okay. Now there's a few new folks here today and a few who have been for the past couple of weeks. But anyway, this is my plan all along, that I'll be doing a brief recap each week just to make sure people are caught up. And then we'll talk about, but we're covering a different topic each week in Buddhist meditation. So these four classes cover more or less the four foundations of mindfulness or establishments of mindfulness, or the four kinds of mindfulness meditation, the four satipatthanas, the first being the body, the second being feelings, third being the mind. And we're discussing the mind today. So we could, now is probably the time we could shut the door. People can still come in, but yeah, no interruptions. Thank you. Okay, so now we're going to be talking about the mind, and I will briefly recap how to meditate from the instructions we've done so far, and then I'll talk about how we're going to develop that for today and some practical reflections on that, and then we'll talk more about the mind and its role in meditation in the talk after the break. Okay, so first of all, a brief recap on how to meditate. First of all Buddhist meditation is grounded in the body, full stop. Okay, so you have to be grounded in mindfulness of the body. And we do this through a number of ways. First of all, through our ethical conduct. Meditation is based on ethics. And without a good moral conduct, your meditation probably won't succeed. And if it does succeed, it's probably bad, because you'll probably use it for bad things. So don't even try it, right? So you need to... ethical conduct is the best thing for meditation. So if you're really struggling with your meditation, always just be a good person. That's the best thing you can do for your meditation. And it might sound, you know, ridiculous or anything like that, but it's not. It really is the foundation. The first third of the Metta Sutta is all about how do you live, how do you conduct yourself. And whether it's looking after rescued kittens, or being nice to people, or just not harming any creature, then there are countless ways that we can reflect and improve our conduct every day. So that's number one. Then when it comes time to meditate, We find a place to sit that's reasonably quiet. We find have a posture to sit in. We have a period of time when we're going to be reasonably undisturbed. And we have a clear purpose in mind. This is very important. When it comes time to meditate, don't be just like drifting around and thinking, oh, now I'm just going to, oh, that was nice, okay? No. You have to have a clear intention in your mind. That's what's going to keep you going, okay? So for this meditation, that purpose is to be like, welcome, just in time. Come. Okay, there are plenty of seats. Well, there's one. Anyway. Okay. Yes, purpose. So for this meditation, we're going to be developing mindfulness of breathing. All right. That means that the breath is the vehicle which will bring you to peace. Okay. So during this meditation, nothing else matters. Only your breath. Okay. So when we begin the meditation, we begin by adopting the posture of meditation, clear in our mind, and we spend a few minutes. Don't go into meditation and try to grab hold of your breath. You spend a few minutes developing an awareness of what your body and your mind feel. This is what we call sampajanya, or clear awareness, or situational awareness. How are you now? Are you tired? Are you anxious? How does your body feel? Are you carrying tension inside yourself? And so we reflect and examine that for a few minutes at the start of the meditation so that we know where we are at, okay? So that's called situational awareness. You spend a few minutes, five minutes or so at the beginning of the meditation. You can do it for longer if you like. You can do that for as long as you like, and it's fine. But at least a few minutes to get an idea of where you're at, and then you begin watching the breath. So when we're watching the breath, mindfully breathing in, mindfully breathing out. Mindfully breathing in, mindfully breathing out. The most important part of that sentence, so that's a direct quote from the Pali Canon, and the most important part of that quote is the word mindfully, which is an adverb, okay? Adverbs are the most important words in spiritual practice. So I first learned this from a Christian theologian who said God is an adverb. Yeah, same thing applies in Buddhism, right? Think about it. You walk mindfully. You're walking anyway, but how do you walk? What is the manner in which you walk? We are breathing anyway, but what is the manner in which we are breathing? We're breathing mindfully. That's it's an adverb. Or you could even say the same thing applies to life. We are living anyway. How are we living? We are living well. Yeah, hopefully. So we are breathing mindfully. And as we breathe mindfully, we notice that the breath, the feeling of the breath, has a silkiness and a smoothness that helps to bring tranquility into our body and into our mind. This is the key to understanding breath meditation. Breath meditation is not about you concentrating on your breath. It's not about you stopping distracting thoughts. It's not about you controlling your mind. It's about your breath bringing peace to you. And when you can step back and allow the breath to bring peace, you will find, like a revelation, that peace has been there all the time and that it is just a veil away. And we have been choosing to mess our minds up. And the potential for peace is contained within us all along. This is the fundamental nature of the Buddha's teachings. We don't look outside for peace, for happiness. It is inside us all along. Okay, so when we find the breath is bringing that sense of peacefulness to the mind, then we find a sense of joy arises. We call that rapture, happiness, and that joy manifests in different ways in We experience it in our body, we experience it in our mind, we experience it in our breath. And that joy can come and go, and it can be experienced in different ways. But ultimately, we are looking for the joy that is inside the breath. It's a part of the experience of the breath, not something which is separate. In fact, the breath is not just physical. The breath is has multiple different dimensions and different layers. We experience the like oxygen and air coming in and out of the lungs, and then it touches our nerve endings and so on, and there's a physical dimension to it. But there's also a spiritual dimension and an emotional dimension to the breath. The deeper that we go into it, the more that we encounter that emotional dimension. And again, I'm not talking about anything mystical here, right? This is just a normal, actual biological function that the breath has. You get born, first thing you do, you breathe, and it tells you, you are alive. That's what I mean when I say that the breath is looking after you. The breath, since the very moment you were born, has been telling you, you are alive. You are still here. You are okay. And so it's been looking after you and taking care of you. So when that dimension of the breath is already there, but when the mind is becoming subtle in meditation, we start to perceive it more and we see that happiness and that joy. Now, when that happiness and that joy of that breath becomes more subtle, becomes more strong, becomes more stable, the mind is starting to become very refined. And as the mind starts to become refined, we start to experience the mind in a different way. We start to experience the mind as a light, as a radiance. You feel a brightness coming into your mind. Like, we use the word brightness as a metaphor for the mind. Like, if somebody's very intelligent and very smart, we'll say, oh, you know, they're a bright kid or something like that. We use that as a metaphor. I'm not talking about that kind of metaphor. I'm talking about a light that appears in your mind that makes you go, did somebody just turn the lights on in the room? And you open your eyes, oh, no, it's just happening inside me. Like, it literally, you experience it like a light. And it comes along gradually, and you feel like your mind is becoming brighter and brighter. And then sometimes it can also happen quite suddenly. Like, you can feel like the moon has just come out from behind the clouds and your mind has just become so bright and clear. So these experiences are associated with what we call samadhi in Buddhist meditation, as the experience of unification of mind. So I'm going to be talking more about these things later on. But before we do that, I want to talk about one practical dimension of understanding the mind in meditation. Okay, so I'm going to be giving an object lesson in how to think about the mind and how to not think about the mind. All right, so okay, here we have a bulk. Right, so most of the time when people talk about meditation in modern times, overwhelmingly how they talk about it is something like this. So you, first of all, you have an object of meditation. Okay, who here has heard that kind of language? People talk about, like, you take an object of meditation, right? Most people, I think, familiar with that kind of language. So you have an object, great. Then you try to concentrate on that object, right? Okay, so I am trying to concentrate on that object. Okay, fine. But then, so that's the meditation instructions. So then people try to do that. And then what the next thing that they say, how's your meditation going? Oh, lots of distracting thoughts keep coming in. Right? Right? Yes, we all know that. That's a basic experience in meditation. And it was about 10, 15 years ago, I kind of realized, hang on, the Buddha doesn't talk about meditation like that at all. Like, none of that is part of the language that the Buddha uses to talk about meditation. How the Buddha talks about meditation, mindfully breathing in, mindfully breathing out. It has a different flavor than try to concentrate on your meditation object, right? So think about what you mean when we're doing this. Think about how this actual works. So first of all, what is an object? It's a weird thing to talk about. It's a weird word to use in the context of meditation, right? I mean, typically an object is something that exists whether we perceive it or not, right? That's what we think. Like I have some drink in this cup. The cup is an object. So when I'm not thinking about that cup, the drink doesn't spill on the ground, right? The cup keeps existing, right? So this is what we think is an object. It exists objectively. But does your breath exist objectively? Is that a thing? That it's not really. Your breath isn't actually a thing at all. It's actually a function. You're breathing. There's no thing that is your breath. It's a process that you're doing. It's a behavior, in fact. So object, so it's part of who you are. So then you have this thing which is part of who you are, right? So then I'm going to try and concentrate on that. Fine. Who am I, by the way? Like, who is the I which is now going to concentrate on the breath? So what I've done is I've actually split off the breath and made it something distinct from me. You see? In my mind, I've said, oh, the breath is an object, which means it's not part of me, which means I'm in here paying attention to this object. It's very problematic. The more you think about it, the more problematic this model is. So, but then who is the I which is paying attention to it? Well, the I, you know who that I is? That I is the good one. That I is the good one. It's the meditator. It's the one who's doing the right thing. I'm going to sit here, I'm going to meditate, I'm going to focus on my breath. I'm the good one. I'm meditating now. Ah, I'm good. Yeah, good. So then what happens? Then we start thinking, oh, think about the way that people think about this. Oh, all of these distracting thoughts keep bothering me. I'm sorry. Where do they come from, these distracting thoughts? I mean, people use this kind of language. Oh, these distracting thoughts kept coming in. Like coming in from where? Like the government beaming them into your mind? Is that where they're coming in from? No. You are making those thoughts. Those thoughts are coming from you. But you have identified as the I, as the good one. So you've split yourself off from all of those thoughts. And you can't see that those thoughts belong to you. I've taught this to long-term meditators who are like, I never realized that. They never realized, oh, actually, I'm the one who's thinking them. But every single distracting thought that comes because of you, from your hopes, your fears, your desires. This is where those thoughts are coming from. So we've now, I'm the good one in here, so I can't be those thoughts because those thoughts are yucky and bad. Not me, okay? I am the good one and I'm concentrating on the breath. So we now have me trying to concentrate on there and then it's very complicated. And then you finish the meditation and you say, how'd it go? It's, oh, it's really a struggle. It's really difficult. Yeah, I'll bet it was, right? So it's weird, isn't it? So this is a linguistic model. It's how people talk about meditation. Look, there's a whole history to that and why we talk about meditation way, which I don't need to get into. But it's a particular set of ideas, and those ideas shape the way that we do meditation. So I'm not saying that model is like completely bad, right? Obviously, lots of people meditate with those kinds of teachings and so on and do perfectly fine. All I'm saying is that there is a tendency to condition you to using your mind in a particular way. Yeah. So think again about how the Buddha talked about meditation. Mindfully breathing in, mindfully breathing out. It's a lot easier, isn't it? Mindfully breathing in, no trying to concentrate, trying to get rid of those distracting thoughts, right? None of that, just mindfully breathing in and mindfully breathing out. And when you do that, when you actually breathe in and out mindfully, you will find that your mind will become peaceful quite quickly and quite easily. And you realize that meditation is, in fact, the easiest thing in the world. It's literally nothing to it. And the only reason it's difficult is because we make it difficult. If you simply breathe, then the breath will bring you to peace. That's it. Okay, so let's do some mindfulness of breathing meditation for the next 20 minutes or so. So sitting quietly. With your back straight, shoulders back, head tilted a little forward. Ground your awareness inside your body. And notice the feelings, the emotions that you're bringing into the meditation, nervousness or excitement, happiness, fear, and just be aware of it. Ah, okay. Have some empathy with how you're feeling. Ah, that's okay. And then bringing awareness to the gentle feeling of the breath as it comes in and the breath as it goes out. Mindfully breathing in. Mindfully breathing out. Mindfully breathing in. Mindfully breathing out. And your mind runs off here and there. Don't worry about it. Just be aware. Ah, okay. My mind's thinking about this. Bring it back. Mindfully breathing in. Mindfully breathing out. Mindfully breathing in. Mindfully breathing out. Notice how when your breath is becoming more peaceful, there is a certain tranquility settling through your limbs, a smoothness. And in that smoothness, there is a pleasure. It feels nice. Sometimes that pleasure is very strong, leaps out. It makes you feel like electricity. But often it's very soft, hardly there at all. But the softness of it is what makes it so beautiful. Mindfully breathing in. Mindfully breathing out. Mindfully breathing in. Mindfully breathing out. Mindfully breathing in, mindfully breathing out.
Mindfully breathing in. Mindfully breathing out. Bringing clarity and precision to your awareness, noticing the very point at which the breath begins, noticing the flow of the breath, and noticing the very point at which the breath ends. Finding that place of balance where the energy of the mind is awakened, and yet the mind and body are completely relaxed. Mindfully breathing in, mindfully breathing out, mindfully breathing in, mindfully breathing out. And as your mind becomes very peaceful, your breath becomes so subtle that it maybe feels like it's almost gone. That soft pleasure settles through the limbs and the body. And inside, as if coming from within you, you can perceive a subtle glow, like a light. It's golden, maybe white. Feels like a light, but it also feels like emotion. Feels like freedom. You can feel that soft glow from within you. You realize that that light and that breath are the same thing. Breath has always been light and life. It's always been energy. And your mind is finally subtle enough to perceive the breath as it really is. Now we're coming near to the end of the meditation. I want you to come back from your breath into your senses. Hear the sounds around you, the sound of my voice, ticking of the clock, birds outside. Feel the touch of cloth on your skin, the pressure of your seat. Give your mind a minute or two to come back to normal. Then reflect back over the course of the meditation. Ask yourself, what just happened? How did my mind change? How did my breath feel? When I started the meditation, what was it like? Was my breath soft or coarse? Was it ragged or hard? And how did that change during the meditation? Did I feel that silkiness of the breath? Did I feel that joy in the breath? Did I feel that brightness? How does my mind feel like now compared to how it was at the start of the meditation? And finally, we can dedicate the merit of our practice. May all beings be happy. May all beings be well. May all beings realize Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Sahana. Okay, very good. Right. So let's have a break for a few minutes and come back for the Dhamma talk. So how was that meditation? It was all right? Anyone have a really terrible meditation? You did? Thank you so much. That is so kind of you. You can set the example for people that it's okay to have a really terrible meditation. I'd like to think it was at least a little bit of me, probably. You know what? Oh, you had a good dose. Excellent. I'm glad some people were managing to sleep in clear awareness of the fact that they were asleep. So, all right. So I'm going to talk a bit about the mind in Buddhism and about how it relates to meditation. So we're talking about cittanupassana, the contemplation of the mind or observation of the mind. And so I'm going to talk, begin the talk with a little bit of theory about how the Buddha understood the mind and how it is structured and how it works according to the teachings of early Buddhism. Okay, so who are you? Not such an easy question, right? So who are we? Like, so there comes a time, it seems, when we're growing up, right? And we sort of begin to question, like, who am I? And we begin to realize that, I'm a person, and that person over there is like also a person, but they're like not me. Somehow, how does that work? And so we've got to figure out that there's who I am. Now, this process, which happens to us when we develop, also happens like culturally, and we can trace it through history. Long before the Buddha, there had been many philosophers who had asked this question: "Who am I?" And the word that they used for that "I" is usually there are many words for it, but one of the words they used is the word "Atman." So I am the Atman, right? The self. Now, originally, the word Atman meant body. So when they said, "Who am I?" Basically, I am this body. That's the basic meaning of Atman. It's a fairly sensible definition. And for practical purposes, we still use that definition. I want to log into my phone. I use my fingerprint. My body says, "This is me." When we, you know, for many purposes, we still identify with our body, and not just formal purposes, but also through our attachments. We're very attached to our body. And interestingly enough, we don't just get attached to our body, but we also get attached to things which are outside our body, like our clothes, for example, or our house, or all of these things that we surround ourselves, we invest some kind of sense of self into. So we are our body. That's solved that problem. I am my body. However, there are a number of issues with that. For example, your body changes. Does that mean that you change? Like, it's kind of a weird thing when you think about it. Like, if I think back right now, everyone can try this. I think back, like, what's your earliest memory, right? What's your earliest memory? I don't know exactly what my earliest memory is, but I know, like, for example, a early memory. If I think right now, the thing that comes to mind is being in a street in Perth, in the city of CBD in Perth, and losing my mum's hand, like feeling like, where's mummy? And like there's a crowd, there's people around, I don't know where I am or don't know what's doing. I have that memory in my mind. That's what came to mind. So I don't know how old I was then, but obviously still pretty young. So I still, when I feel that memory, I can still feel those emotions. I can still feel like that little kid was me somehow. But, I mean, physically, obviously, I've changed. I mean, a little bit. and um, but
but I still feel like it's me. And then, of course, you have other changes, right? So if you, let's say you have your, you lose your arm gets amputated. Does that mean like a piece of yourself is gone? Or what happens when you die? It's a disturbing thought. Does that mean that yourself goes? So then people sort of question this, and then people say, okay, well, rather than identifying with the body, then they identify maybe with feelings. People like to identify with feelings because people like to be happy. And I like to say, oh, I remember those happy feelings. And we feel like when we die that we would like to experience a lot more of those happy feelings. That's what we call heaven, right? You die and you go to heaven, lots of happy feelings. That's nice to think about. Okay. But, of course, then that's also a bit problematic because feelings come and go, like, all the time. And if I am this feeling, then what am I when that feeling has gone? Anyway, so that you can see that this process of reflection, philosophical inquiry, contemplation, it goes on. Now, ultimately, you come to a point where you kind of think, well, I am the one who observes all of this. Yeah. And this was the state that the most profound philosophers shortly before the Buddha had reached, especially a sage called Yajnavalkya. And Yajnavalkya lived about 100, 200 years before the Buddha in the same region that the Buddha lived in. And he was the first one, so far as we know, who unequivocally said, consciousness is this self. Yeah, Vijnana Ganameva, this sheer mass of consciousness, this Mahabuddha, this sheer mass of consciousness, this is myself. The unseen seer, the unheard hearer, the unthought thinker, the unknown knower. Yeah? And there's something profound about this. Now, from a Buddhist point of view, we know that the Buddha, if you're familiar with Buddhist teachings, the Buddha said that there's no such thing as a self. And Buddhists often are too blithe with how they think about self. They say, oh, the Buddha taught not self. And what that means is that they're not really considering what was the Buddha talking about when he talked about a self. What was he actually saying is not self? And until we can really understand what the Buddha was talking about, what the self that he was critiquing was, we don't understand what not self is. So the Buddha said that consciousness is not self. Okay, but what is that consciousness? Why was that important? So think about it. When we see, like we feel like I'm in here seeing out there. We feel like I'm in here hearing that. But the thing which is seeing is not seeing. Even if we look in a mirror, we're not seeing the seer. We're seeing a reflection, an image. So that which knows, the consciousness or the vijnana or the citta, that which is kind of feels like it's at the center of all of these things and it feels like it remains the same while all of these things change. It's very elusive and very hard to see how it might be changing. And this is why even the greatest sages and philosophers, the greatest meditators, believed that this was eternal. They believed this lasted forever because it kind of feels like it does. It feels like I'm in here observing things and I was here yesterday observing things and I was here the day before. And the Buddha said, no, 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 this is something that you've constructed. This sense of self is something you've constructed and that you are actively constructing right now. We call it ahamkara. So he said that the mind, yes, he partially agreed with what Yajnavalkya had said. Yes, he agreed that mind and subjective awareness is extremely important. It is, in fact, like the center of our experience and about what we call ourselves as a person. But it's not something that's eternal or lasts forever. It's actually another conditioned process. And so he understood our mind and our experience as a network of conditions. So think about that. Think about the metaphor of science and of nature, how nature works. So in the Upanishads, that is to say the pre-Buddhist philosophers, they said that all of our individual names and forms are like the rivers, that flow down to the ocean. And the ocean is eternal. Yeah, it's a very beautiful image. And again, I don't think we can understand these images by critiquing them. We have to understand them by being empathetic with them. It's a beautiful idea. Think about it. Like all of the individuals in this world, all different, all have their different preferences and so on, their different names and shapes. Like all the rivers, they flow into that ocean and everyone becomes one in that ocean, which is eternal. Yeah? It's kind of a beautiful idea. Of course, if we understand ecology, we know it's completely wrong because the ocean isn't eternal and the ocean is, in fact, a part of that same system. And the oceans evaporate, cause the rain clouds rain, and they cause the rivers. And it, in fact, is a system. And the ocean is not, it's not that the rivers are impermanent and the ocean is eternal. Actually, they are all part of a system. That's what the Buddha was saying that our mind is like. There's no one thing that is just eternal and lasts forever. No mind, no consciousness, nothing like that. But there is a cycle which is constantly conditioning and reconditioning and changing and shaping. That's how the Buddha understood the mind. Now, once we understand that, it informs the way that we approach meditation practice. One of the key words for meditation in Buddhism is citta bhavana. Citta, the mind, bhavana, we usually translate it as development, right? So development of the mind or just a word for meditation. But citta bhavana, bhavana is literally the causative form from the root to be. So literally means to make it be more. Right? Citta bhavana means making the mind be more. And think about what that means. Think about what all of the things that's in your mind, memories, emotions, thoughts, insights, rationality, perceptions, creativity, conflicts, anger, all of those things made more. So meditation has a capacity to increase and to make more everything that's in your mind. Now, hopefully, we want to make more the good things that's in your mind, right? That's what the whole path of meditation is for. But that's not always the case, though. If you're careless, you can slip up. You can make your mind very powerful in meditation and then let it go over to anger, and then you can have really strong anger. It can happen, right? But generally speaking, we are developing the wholesome and the constructive parts of the mind through meditation. And you can experience this, and in fact, you do experience this every single time you meditate, the transformation of consciousness. When you sit down to meditate, 2 minutes later, you're like, oh, my mind's thinking about this. All right? Maybe that's a bit ambitious. 1 minute later, your mind's... 10 seconds later, your mind is off thinking about something. And you're like, oh, my meditation's no good because my mind is off thinking about things. That's how people think. It's the wrong way to think. Actually, that is a sign that your meditation is successful, because you are aware of the fact that you are thinking. That is a crucial part in developing meditation. You are aware that your mind is thinking. Our mind is doing all that stuff anyway, but we just don't know it. And now we are becoming more aware of how our mind works. That's the beginning. You sit there and meditate a little bit longer. Ow, I've got this itch here. I want to scratch my itch. I don't know if I should scratch my itch or not. Oh, I'm such a bad meditator. No. Now you are aware of your itches more than you ever were before. That is the growth of your awareness. That's the growth of your consciousness. That's citta bhavana, right? You're sitting there, you're meditating. Meditate. And you're like, bloody hell, that was that email I was supposed to reply to, right? You're like, oh, I'm such a terrible meditator. No. Your memory has just improved, okay? Memory has just grown. That's telling you that the meditation is working. Right? You're sitting there meditating, meditate, and you're like, oh my God, that thing that I did, that was so embarrassing. And you're like, oh. And you're like, but that was like 10 years ago. Why do I still feel like that? And, oh, I'm such a bad meditator. No. Your mind is becoming more clear. All of these are signs of chitta bhavana. Your mind is becoming more powerful. You will find your creativity is better. Your problem solving is better, right? Your confidence is better. Yeah? All of these things will improve through the meditation. And this is all a sign that your mind is growing. Now, these are all the different aspects or features of the mind. Okay, that we thought, your memory, imagination, thoughts, reasoning, so on and so forth. These are all functions or features of the mind. Okay, and these all happen within the awareness. So in Buddhism, we talk about, and again, just a little bit of theory. In Buddhism, we talk about consciousness and nama rupa. So consciousness is the awareness of, nama rupa is that which we are aware of. Right. So nama rupa means name and form. Right. So again, think about it from a very basic sense. This is a form. When we see it, it has a form. Right? And then we give it a name. It's a cup. So a name and form is identifying this unique thing as opposed to all of the other things around us. So this is in a very simple way how our mind works, by distinguishing different things in awareness. So I am aware of this name and form, this nama rupa. So this is something, I don't want to get too much into the theory of it, but this is basically how the Buddhist model of consciousness works. The name and form conditions our mind conditions the name and form. What does that mean in meditation? What it means is that if the things of which I am aware are terrifying and stressful and distressing, my mind becomes distressed because of it. And I experience those as unpleasant emotions and unpleasant feelings. But if the thing of which I am aware is peaceful and soothing and beautiful, then it brings those qualities to your mind. And when the mind is then feeling those qualities, then they will also imbue the name and form with those qualities. Think about that in the context of meditation. When you sit down to meditate, first of all, we take our mind away from all of that distraction and complexity around us. Close your eyes. We've already simplified our world a lot. Bring the mind to the present. Past and the future is all gone. Now we just have the present. And that is much simpler. We pay attention to the breathing. And the breathing brings a stillness and a smoothness to the mind. Yeah. Ah, and we are experiencing that. So our mind becomes more open, becomes more bright, becomes more aware. The mind knows better. And as the mind knows better, becomes more conscious, the breath itself becomes more refined. Right? The mind is the consciousness, the breath is the name and form in this case. And that becomes more subtle. And then that is then conditioning the mind to become more subtle, and the mind is then conditioning the breath to come, and so on and so forth, until they support each other in a virtuous cycle where they are conditioning each other to become more and more subtle. That's how meditation works. That's the fundamental mechanism of meditation. By bringing our attention to that which is peaceful, the qualities of that which is peaceful are brought to the mind. And when those qualities are brought to the mind, that which is peaceful becomes more peaceful. Again, this is one of the reasons why I don't like the language of object, because an object stays the same regardless. But that's not how your breath is. Your breath changes in your awareness and through your awareness. So there is a process, a cycle, a virtuous cycle. And the breath becomes more and more subtle, more and more beautiful. The mind becomes more and more clear, more and more bright, more and more aware. Now, so that's how the meditation works. As that process continues, you'll find that that brightness will become stronger or become more clear. So I'm not going to talk about this in too much detail because we don't have too much time, but let me just briefly outline the stages of how meditation usually proceeds. So to begin with, we begin with practicing mindfulness, being aware of the breath, breathing in and out, and that's what we did today when we started our meditation. That's fine. So most people can do that. Not everyone. And I'd have to say that probably there are some people who simply don't have the presence of mind to even be aware of the breath, or even being aware of the breath might itself have some negative effects. For example, somebody who may be subject to panic attacks, for example, sometimes might try being aware of the breath and then grab hold of it, and it can actually induce a panic attack. It can happen. So there are some people for whom even that stage is not really going to work. So there are other ways we can then work with people's meditation in that case. I had one student when I was on a retreat in Italy, and he had this kind of problem. And we kept on suggesting, it was like a 10-day retreat, kept on suggesting solutions. He'd go away and try it. He said, no, this one isn't working. And then he had some other. And there was all like legitimate issues. And, you know, he had panic attacks, or he had like seizures, and like opening your eyes didn't work because then you get a migraine. And we're going like trying to all of these different things to try to overcome it. And by the end of the retreat, he was able to meditate happily. Yeah, it was really kind of amazing. Yeah, it was great to see his persistence through that. So anyway, but for most of us, we're able to be aware of the breath and find a degree of peace, bodily tranquility. So it's like the first part of breath meditation where you realize that it's actually working. You sit there and meditate, even for 5 or 10 minutes, hopefully maybe for 20 minutes, then you can feel your mind and body is significantly more tranquil than it was at the start of the meditation. So that's a genuine experience and a genuine benefit of breath meditation. And if that's what your meditation is, that is fantastic, because that is already something that's incredibly valuable. And you have learned that you can develop that peace inside yourself. Don't have to take any drugs. Don't have to rely on some deity to give you the peace. You don't have to do anything like that. There's nothing complicated. You don't have to subscribe to an app. None of these things. You can just breathe and be peaceful. That's incredible. That's incredible. Think about how messed up the world is, because there are so many people who are just unable to be peaceful. It's ridiculous. A bit of meditation can make all the difference. Okay, so we found that, first of all, that peacefulness. Now then within that, we can find that pleasure, okay? Now, finding the pleasure, I talked about this last week, the happiness can be a bit tricky, but not that difficult. We're not talking about any profound realization or transformation, but we can find that pleasure in it, we can feel that. And then what we're talking about this week is like the brightness of consciousness and the brightness of awareness. And again, I think probably most people can feel that or sense that in their meditation if they've learned to meditate for at least a reasonable amount of time. I don't know, like 20 minutes or 30 minutes or something like that. Or maybe if you've been on a retreat, you probably have some idea of what I'm talking about. Okay, so when that brightness manifests in a way that is quite clear and powerful, the terminology we use today is nimitta. I'm just going to talk briefly about nimitta. I should mention that in the suttas, it doesn't really talk about nimittas using this language. Actually, in the suttas, that is to say in the Pali canon that the Buddha actually himself taught, it usually just calls it the brightness and talks about the brightness of the mind or the radiance of the mind or the light in the mind and so on. Or it talks about the rupa, the visions or the appearances you see in the mind. But doesn't use the word nimitta in this case. So I'm just mentioning this because this can cause confusion when sometimes reading the sutta. But the word nimitta is a word that's used in the commentarial tradition. It's very widely used in modern Theravada meditation circles. So nimitta means a sign, all right? That's all. It's a simple, everyday word, and it means a sign. So a nimitta is when you walked into this building and you saw the sign that said, come to this room for the meditation. That's a nimitta, right? If you wanted to say there was a sign there in Pali, you would say there was a nimitta. Okay, so it's not like a special metaphysical word or anything like that. It's just a word that means a sign. What is it a sign of? It is a sign that your mind is becoming purified. Okay, then the brightness that you perceive in the meditation is your mind's way of telling you, good on you. That's all. Mind is telling you, hey, you're going great. Your meditation's going great. Keep going. Yeah, that's what it's a sign of. It's a sign that your mind is becoming more pure. And your mind describes itself to itself using that perceived metaphor of light. Why? Because of the sunrise. Because we are asleep at night and then we wake up in the dawn. And we wake up in the light. And that is very conditioned in our mind at a very basic level to say, oh, awakening is brightness. And that's what we perceive it as, brightness. And when you're sitting in meditation, you can be literally sitting in a completely dark room and you feel that your mind is filled with light. You think someone's turned the lights on. And you open your eyes and say, oh, no, they haven't turned the lights on. It's just inside me. And you close your eyes and you're like, no, it's not inside me anymore. It's gone now. Where is it? So don't do that. Yeah. So it appears really like a light and it can be flickering and weak. It can be very bright. Like a strong emitter will be like the radiance of the sun. It will be just like, it will appear in the mind with such power and such majesty that it just wipes away any doubts, any darkness, any defilements you have in your mind. They're not even thinkable. It's just gone. And you begin to realize that the mind is capable of such incredible power. This is why when sages before the Buddha, right, the Brahmanical sages, Vedic sages would practice, they would see this, then they would say, this is God. Quite naturally, yeah. It feels like God. It feels like this immense, infinite source of power and love and light, and it manifests in your mind. And if you believe in God, that's what you're going to think. You're going to think this is God, right? If you're a Christian sage, you're going to sit there and you're going to meditate and you're going to say, oh, I caught a glimpse of God, right? You keep on meditating, you go deeper, then you say, oh, now I've become God. So if you do the first one, they'll call you a saint. If you do the second one, they'll call you a heretic. So you have to be careful about that. But anyway, but that's what it is. That's what it feels like. And so that's how magnificent and powerful and transformative that experience is. And in a way, the Buddha would agree with that. He would say, yeah, actually, that is what God is, right? But it's actually just you. That is the power that is within you. And that is like a divine power, a transcendent power, which manifests through the mind, which is freed from hindrances, freed from that which darkens it, freed from that which constricts it and fragments it. And it's an astonishing thing. It really is. It's an astonishing thing that each one of us has that potential within us. And it's not something that I'm just making up. Remember that I just talked about the process of meditation. You can sit there at the beginning and you can feel the mind starting to be peaceful. And everyone here, I'm sure pretty much everyone here, has actually experienced that. All we're talking about is the continuation of that process. It's just step by step by step. And when I'm talking about it now, probably sounds like I'm talking about something very far away or something very metaphysical or something like that. But when you experience it, it will seem to you like the most natural thing that's ever happened to you. It will seem to you like you've come home at last. It will seem to you like this is actually how it's always been. My mind has actually always been like this, but I've never actually seen it. That's what the experience of samadhi feels like. So when we're meditating, we're practicing, we are moving towards this kind of state. It's a transformation of consciousness, what the Buddha said, making the mind more, citta bhavana. So this is a few words for this evening on the mind or consciousness in the context of meditation. I don't know if there are any questions for this evening. Yeah, please, see if there's any online.
Me?
Yeah, please, yep.
You were talking about consciousness this evening.
Yeah.
What said.
Right.
So how does that relate to, I've heard about the Buddhist term infinite consciousness.
Uh-huh, yep.
So where does that?
So the question was about the infinity of consciousness as a stage of meditation. So this was one of the stages of meditation which those pre-Buddhist sages had realized. And so it seems like this is quite a difficult area of study because the way that the pre-Buddhist philosophers talked about meditation is very different to the way that the Buddha talked about it. One of the Buddha's main innovations was that he talked about meditation in purely a psychological sense, whereas they talked about it in a very metaphysical sense. Right, so this makes it very difficult to, you know, it's hard to say like exactly that this one is that. But this is an area that I've researched quite a lot. And so it seems to me that the pre-Buddhist sages were in fact practicing these kinds of meditation, like infinite consciousness. And so this is like a level of awareness where any kind of limitations on the mind are gone. Okay. In classical Theravada, they describe it that you have a nimitta, which is a rupa, which is like a light. Then when that light becomes infinite, we call that infinite. You can then take that. So the light becomes infinite. This is the way the classical Theravada describes it. The light becomes infinite. That's nice, right? Then you take away that infinite light and you have infinite space, which is where that light used to be. And then you take away that infinite space and you have the infinite consciousness of what was the infinite space. Yeah, so you can see this is all getting very abstract. Yeah. Yes?
I think it's true for this. Now, inside of you, and if you're in a closed area,
yeah,
and you're meditating,
yeah,
so far it does not have to do with saying, if you get the nimitta,
No, that's not correct at all. I think there's a misunderstanding of some of the Visuddhimagga meditation instruction. So the question was whether if you're sitting meditation in a room and you have a nimitta, should you get out of the room and come back again? No, you should not. But I think that that's a misunderstanding of the first meditation in Visuddhimagga is the earth casino. Right? So how that they describe that is you make a disc, like a dish out of earth, which is like coloured like dawn from mud, and then you can meditate on that. You meditate on the earth. And you do this outside. So you're sitting on a small stool, right? You're not sitting in lotus posture. You're sitting on a small stool outside in clear light, and you're actually focusing visually on it. This is actually where I think the language of object comes from, because obviously this is in fact an object, right? This is I'm focusing on this object, right? So that language applies in that case, right? Not in the case of the breaths, but you focus on that object. When you start to get the counterpart of that earth nimitta, birth kasina, right? That disc. Then, according to Visuddhimagga, you should get up from your seat and go inside into your heart, and then you continue with just the mental counter image. Okay? So it sounds like maybe that's like a confusion from that particular instruction. Yeah. But that doesn't apply in breath meditation or metta meditation or anything. I think the idea is that if you're like once your mind is starting to get refined like that, if you're sitting outside, then maybe, you know, insects will bite you or light will come on and off or people disturb you or something, so you go to a quieter place. Yeah. Not in breath meditation. Yeah. Good. Sinsin.
I've got a question about metta.
Yeah.
Experienced by two different people.
Okay.
One is a Buddhist, the other one is.
Okay.
Actually, it did happen. So I heard it.
Okay.
The person who's not Buddhist apparently is a good meditator. She experiences the metta all the time. She said she's just bathing in mind. She thinks normal.
Right.
But she doesn't know it.
Okay, so let me just mention briefly for the thing, Sinsin's asking about one meditator who is not a Buddhist, has meditates and has a nimitta all the time like bathing in light, and she doesn't realise how. She just thinks that's normal. Okay.
The other person?
Yeah.
Understanding?
Yeah.
She didn't really experience until one day.
All right.
She experienced it, she got excited, and the nimitta's gone.
That's right. So the other person never had any nimittas, they meditated, experiences the nimitta, and it got excited. Yay, got a nimitta. Oh, there, where's it gone now? Yeah, very common, very normal, yeah. Dhamma Uddhaccha, that's called, yeah, getting excited about the Dhamma. Feels like a little bit of a double-edged sword. Why is that?
Yeah. So the other person
didn't know. Oh, what? So one is too blasé about the nimitta, and one is too excited about it. Yeah, yeah. Okay. So look, all of these things can happen, and the basic advice in all of those cases is just keep practicing. So what you said before can be the case. There's a fairly small number of meditators, but it does happen, where they just sit and they meditate and the mind just naturally is very bright or something, right? Whatever it is, past life practice or whatever, who knows? But it can be that they don't really realize how special that is, yeah? And so that they don't necessarily have like a lot of motivation to continue practice. So that's really the key for them, is to have that understanding, oh, this is a great place to start, right? And if you really pursue that practice, then you can go very deeply. I mean, the same thing happens in any field, right? You can get people who are like naturally maybe very good musicians or naturally very good singers, but they never actually pursue it. So the other case is somebody who meditates, never get anywhere. Finally, oh, my goodness, I get a nimitta. Yay, it's gone. Very common. Very common, very normal. Nothing to do, just keep going, okay? Well, the only thing that you might do is before the meditation, okay, at the beginning of the meditation, like once you've done the clear comprehension, right, so you sit there, do the clear comprehension meditation for a few minutes, then just remind yourself, everything I see is not me, it's not mine, it's not myself, okay? Just remind yourself of that, and then you begin the meditation, and so you don't get attached to things and so on. But it's quite normal that this will happen, okay? So you just keep on doing it, and then over time you'll be okay. Yeah.
So that one's
pretty good. Really? Okay, thank you for that. Look, I've got a couple of comments online, so let me read them before we wrap up. From Venerable Dhammakippa, how's it going, Venerable? She's been away for a little while since the last time I've done the talks. I've been to Sri Lanka for my higher ordination. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Venerable Dhammakippa, many of us who've been seeing this online for the last few years will be familiar with her. She's been in Sri Lanka for the higher ordination for the last few days in Washington, D.C., visiting president, no. I'm sorry. Walking with the peace monks. And it was one of the most incredible experiences of my life. DC was full of people in the robes. Oh, that's amazing. Yeah, really incredible. Many people have seen them, had seen Bhikkhu Bodhi in there. And that's awesome. I'm so glad that you had that opportunity. And that's one of the, like, so many terrible things happening. Oh, my goodness. And they're just standing up and they're showing that you can do something really powerful and really beautiful. Okay. So then Venerable Prasanna then says, Venerable Dhammakippa, I saw you on the live stream from Washington. Okay, nice. So Key says, is breath the Buddha refers to similar to the Indian prana or is it Chinese chi? Yeah, of course, it's the same thing. It's the Indian prana. Is it reasonable to be mindful and notice a prana chi energy going through the body? Yes. So generally speaking, breath in Indian philosophy is regarded as energies that are moving through your body. So as well as the physical air is also the movement of energies, yeah. So Venerable Prasanna, thank you for reminding us. Sydney folks, we're going to be doing Pindabhava in Burwood on this Sunday. So you can join us. We'll be doing alms round at around 11 o'clock and joining for the picnic around 11:30. And following that, a sutta discussion at Rhonda Place in Concord at 3 p.m. And this will be the Ratapala Sutta Part 2. So thanks for that, Venerable. Okay. So look, we should wrap up here. A couple of people are leaving. Reminder that the last of these series of four talks will be on next week, and that will be on the Dhammas, contemplation of Dhammas, or the principles of the Dhamma. And We are here on Fridays at Crow's Nest. Crow's Nest will be an ongoing talk, so this series will finish next Friday, but the session will continue. And I will be next week announcing what we're going to be doing for the next four sessions. All right. And concurrently, we are running the same classes in Parramatta at 5 Parramatta Square. So that's at the 5 at 6. Don't blame me, okay? All complaints about the naming take to the Parramatta Council. But anyway, 5 is the name of the community hub in Parramatta Square, and the meeting is at 6 p.m. It's a library. Yeah, Parramatta Library. I don't know why they didn't just call it. Anyway, whatever. Fine. That's fine with P-H-I-N-E. Okay. Okay. So that's I think all for now. Oh yes, the gosh, I keep forgetting to put. I'll do it tomorrow morning. But the retreat in Broken Hill or outside Broken Hill is on, and so we're taking bookings for that already. So please come and join us in the middle of the desert, Megan. We're practically in your backyard. I mean, it's not quite there, but it's getting there. So that's going to be in, I think it's April or May. May, is it? So please join for that. It's going to be incredible. And also let you know, we haven't started doing the details for this yet, but we will be doing a retreat at the end of the year in Sydney as well. So if you can't make it out to the desert, we'll be doing another retreat. That's it. I was going to ask if maybe for the folks who are here today in Sydney, Would you be okay if we took a photo?
Yeah.
Can we take a group photo and share it? I was with the Metta Center group on Wednesday, and they always take a photo of the group. And I thought, we've never done that. Why can't we do it? So would that be okay? Everybody happy? Okay, let's do it. So for folks online, well, I'm going to turn the computer around. So if you want to be the folks online, we can have you in the photo as well. I don't see anything, but we'll do what we can. Okay. We'll turn you around. Everybody, I think we come here and gather around the shrine and so on. Just, I'll sort of say the Hasa will take the photo. Everybody come here. Everyone gather around. If you don't want to be in the photo, that's all right. But please do come. I'm going to pick that out there. Right. Come around. See how the photo looks. See how the photo looks. Probably go there. Come, everyone, come. Yes, very good. Stand at the back, and maybe some folks can kneel in front or something like that. And standers and kneelers, and I'll be here with. Yep, get rid of those. They don't look like an alcoholic. Okay, are we good? Are we good? Have we got everyone in the photo? Okay, turn the lights on. Can we turn the lights on? Is everyone okay with that? Okay, good. Okay. We got everyone in? We've got more space in the front here. We've got room for a few kneelers. Alex, come. Everyone come. Yeah, get a bit closer in the front here. Yeah. How are we going? Okay. No. We'll give that to Nalushi, and Nalushi will send it out of the email list. And so if you're not on the email list, you can subscribe. And please share it on whatever social media that people know. And, yeah, tell everyone to come along.
Is
this your phone?
Nope.
No? Yep. Sorry. Ah, it's about like going out with pet in the middle of the desert. It's going to be awesome. About a week?
Should come. I've been to Broken Hill. I love it there.
Ah, okay.
Send me in the middle of nowhere. I love it.
Right.
So where can they get
On our website, which is the Lokanta Vihara website, but it's not actually there yet, but it will be soon. Yeah. But Nalushi, if you put your name down, subscribe, okay, then Nalushi will put it there as well. So bye-bye, all online friends. Bye-bye. See you next week.